From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about television news with John Chancellor, former NBC News anchor, now a network news analyst. Also, we meet Scott Spencer, the author of Endless Love. In his new novel, Secret Anniversaries, Spencer departs from the obsessive, confessional narrative style he became known for. World music commentator Milo Miles reviews a new album, which teams up African folk musicians with the English group Three Mustafas Three. And commentator Maureen Corrigan shops for her wedding dress. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro has suspended a civil service law. Her decree has touched off what Sandinista unions claim is a nationwide strike, protesting the suspension and demanding salary increases. The government has declared the strike illegal. Robert Meyerowitz reports from Managua.
15 days after taking office, Violeta Chamorro has used her executive powers to suspend the country's civil service law, which protects over 100,000 state employees from layoffs. The law was passed in the National Assembly by the Sandinistas after they lost elections last February. In response, the pro-Sandinista State Workers Union has declared a general strike. State workers have reported to their offices where they're refusing to work and have prevented government officials from entering. At a news conference this morning, Mrs. Chamorro defended her power to rule by decree, saying strong measures were necessary because the Sandinistas have plundered and bankrupted the country. She also decreed that some farmlands that have been confiscated by the Sandinistas would be returned to their former owners until a new commission could establish who the rightful owners should be. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
The presidents of the Baltic republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are set tomorrow to meet in a historic summit. The three leaders plan to work on a draft statement of economic and political cooperation in their fight for independence from the Soviet Union. An Estonian spokesman said today that they'll also demand seats in the United Nations as independent states. Continuing reports of campaign violence and intimidation of Romania's opposition groups are casting a shadow over the country's upcoming elections. This week, the U.S. State Department recalled the U.S. ambassador to discuss its concerns about organized intimidation and harassment. And today, a leading opposition party quit the provisional parliament in protest of the violence. Kathleen Hunt reports from Bucharest.
Of the American ambassador, Alan Green, to Washington for consultations less than 2 weeks before Romania's elections is the latest sign of the State Department's growing concern about Romania's progress towards democracy. Earlier this week, Washington warned that campaign violence against opposition parties would threaten the improvement of relations with the United States. Officially, the interim government of Ion Iliescu has played down the importance of the U.S. ambassador's departure, but privately they're angered. Yet with only 9 days to go till Iliescu's near-certain landslide, the former communist official seems as uncompromising as ever. And it's not likely that even today's protest withdrawal of the opposition peasant party from the provisional parliament will make him postpone the elections and end the campaign violence. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
On Wall Street today, stock prices closed sharply higher, gaining 63 points to close at 2,801.58. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-1. This is NPR News. Some 50,000 people are reported stranded without food or water on the southern coast of India. They were cut off during the past 2 days as the worst cyclone of the decade swept in from the Bay of Bengal. At least 100 villages were reported flooded and thousands of homes destroyed. The death count so far has climbed to 210 people. Many towns and villages in the area are still without electricity, and wells have been contaminated with seawater brought in by the storm. The bad weather delayed relief efforts, but the storm was reported to be abating today. The State Department says a Chinese couple who fled their homeland's forced abortion policy qualify for U.S. refugee status. The decision by the State Department clears the way for the couple to receive political asylum. From member station WBFO in Buffalo, Tony Randolph reports.
Jin Mu Li and his wife Sei Zhen Wang fled China in October. In November, President Bush issued a directive that grants asylum to people like the Lees who flee forced abortions or sterilizations in their native countries. The Lees are the first known cases to test that directive. The couple had been awaiting a U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service hearing that would decide whether they could stay in the United States. The Lees' attorney, Kathleen Remar, believes the new ruling from state is a positive sign.
In about 99.9% of the cases, whatever the State Department says in their advisory opinion is usually the decision that's given by the Immigration Service.
The State Department says the Lees qualify for refugee status under federal law. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph in Buffalo.
Officials in the Philippines said today that 7 people were killed and 82 injured in an explosion and fire aboard a Philippine Airlines jet in Manila. The plane, with 115 people on board, was preparing for takeoff when the explosion occurred. Police say the blast may have been caused by a bomb. The airline president said the blast apparently occurred near the center of the aircraft. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Chancellor got into TV so early, he didn't even own a TV yet. Chancellor was a pioneer in the development of network TV news. During his 40 years at NBC, Chancellor has reported from 50 different countries, covered every presidential election since 1956, and was the anchorman for the NBC Nightly News for 12 years. He's now the senior commentator and senior political analyst for NBC News. Chancellor has expanded on his role as news analyst and written a book that he calls A Commentary on America. It's titled Peril or Promise. I asked John Chancellor if it was difficult for him to change from being an objective reporter into a commentator who takes a point of view.
Yes. The first commentaries for about a year were like lawyer's briefs because I believed I had to prove everything. And then I began to relax a little bit. And it is a big change because I anchored for 12 years and tried to have no side or bias or anything in what I reported. And still, I think I am in commentaries pretty much free of any right or left orientation. I've always described myself as a member of the extreme center.
Do you see the extreme center as being neutral and unbiased, or being a political point of view as opinionated as the left or the right, only it's in the middle?
I argue in the book, In Peril and Promise, that the old ideological extremes are out of date in the United States, that the old ideological labels don't mean much anymore, that a lot of the steam has gone out of traditional conservatism in the United States. The Cold War is over. The New Deal and its successor programs on the left, I think, have run out of energy and steam some time ago. And I think what I'm arguing is for a kind of new pragmatism that would not have these old labels of the past.
I guess what I'm thinking, too, and this is to paraphrase something that David Halberstam once wrote, that there in the news, being in the center is seen as being neutral, but it's a point of view as much as any other. I wonder if you'd agree with that.
Well, I think I understand what he's saying, and that is that you get good ideas here, there, and everywhere that could be put into legislation or into policies. And I think that being in the center, it's much easier to take things from the extremes or from each side, more than the extremes, and try to make coherent policy or law out of them. So I agree with David on that.
You recommend that we do away with presidential primaries.
Mm-hmm.
What would you replace them with?
Party conventions. The kinds of conventions we had up until about 1960. The conventions that we have today are really not political. The nominee is picked in primaries, in what I call the roll of the dice in the primaries, months before the convention assembles, and it's a sham convention. And Terry, we are the only democracy in the world that uses elections to choose candidates for the highest office. So I recommend their abolition.
Well, you say that you think the excitement won out of presidential campaigns after Goldwater and LBJ in 1964?
Yeah.
Now, you were arrested at the Republican convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco in 64.
Detained is the word my mother used.
Would you refresh our memories about what happened.
Well, no, it was just one of those, let's clear the aisles and get the press and the delegates out of the aisles, and somebody sent some sheriff's deputies over, and I had been given a seat by the Arizona delegation, and I wasn't really in the aisle, and so we had a little verbal tussle, and then they walked me out, and about 15 seconds after they walked me out of the Cow Palace in San Francisco, an ashen-faced chief sergeant-at-arms at the Republican convention turned me around and shoved me back on the floor. He knew they'd made a terrible mistake.
So you didn't feel like you were being singled out by people who were anti-press?
No more than the rest of the press, because that was one of the most singularly anti-press conventions either party has ever had. That was the convention when Eisenhower, and I was standing just below the podium when he said it, when Eisenhower denounced self-serving commentators and columnists. And there was this feral roar from the Goldwater delegates in the hall. And Ike was surprised. I was a little surprised. And I know I looked up at him, and he sort of took a half step back, a little surprised that they were that angry about the press. So I didn't feel singled out. There were 3,000 of us there who were hated in the Cow Palace.
My guest is John Chancellor, and he's an NBC News senior political analyst. He's also the author of a new book, which is called Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. You covered elections for years. Can we get back to some of the early elections that you covered? Would you describe a little bit what the technology was like, counting and analyzing votes before computers?
Well, what you did was you... one and one made two, and you went from there. You had blackboards. You had long yellow pads. It was a lot more fun. It went on all night, and nobody knew how it was going to come out. The 1960 election, in which John F. Kennedy won, was not decided in the Eastern time zone until, 9 in the morning or something like that. We were up all night. One of the problems, and I argue this in the book, is that what Theodore H. White used to call the making of the president has now become the merchandising of the president. And technology has a lot to do with that, Terry. I think you know this. But the idea of campaigns when I first started back in 1952 covering national politics was that you would get crowds who would actually ad oculum, as they taught us in school, they would look at the candidate with their eyeballs. And now it's all gone to television. But in those days, the size of the crowds, the motorcades, the number of people who could be in the stadium, the number of people who were at the airport, or in 1952, in many cases, the railroad station, were very important. There were a few polls, but not very many. The polling really got started in about 60, the serious and sophisticated polling.
John Chancellor is my guest, and he's written a new book called Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. During the 12 years that you anchored, did you feel the pressure of consultants and audience research? And I think there's been much more of a premium placed on audience research and media consultants in recent years.
No, I don't think so. And, you know, in looking back on it, in a rapidly changing world, being a television network anchorman is a job with a lot of job security. Cronkite did it, I think, for 16 years. Huntley and Brinkley were together for almost that long, or maybe that long. I did it for 12 years. For much of the time when I was anchoring, NBC was second to CBS in the ratings. Both Walter and I were, and are, middle-aged, professorial men of no great particular sex appeal. Sorry, Walter, if you're listening, but that's true. They kept us on because we were not influenced by, or the networks were not influenced by consultants who would say, put a pretty face on there, by the audience ratings, people who might say, or some programmers who would say, do anything to become number one. And this, I think, to a great extent, extends today into Rather and Jennings and Brokaw.
How did you define your job as anchor? I mean, beyond what we saw when we tuned in the news, what were you doing behind the scenes as the news developed during the day? You were the editor of the show as well, weren't you?
Yeah, well, pretty much the editor, but you never... the titles managing editor or editor and all of that really indicate that you're part of a team. It's usually a team of four or five people, sometimes only three, who really have the ultimate decision on what goes on the program in what order. And I was part of that team, and I suppose because I was an anchor, certainly in the later years, I could pick the lead of the program and do that. The fun of anchoring, for me at any rate, always was putting the program together. Reading the introductions to other correspondents on the air was secondary to me. I enjoyed the struggle to get to put into a 22-minute package the important and meaningful news of the day and see to it that it got reported well. That was the fun.
John Chancellor is my guest, NBC News senior political analyst. He was an anchor for 12 years. Now he's written a new book. It's called Peril and Promise, a commentary on America. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Chancellor is my guest. How did you get your first TV job?
I got the job in television because I had been, I can't think of the word that they use today, but there was a big economy wave at the Chicago Sun-Times where I was a reporter, and there were about 70 people, editorial employees, let go, and Chicago was a four-newspaper town. And it was very, very difficult to stay in the newspaper business. I got in the newspaper business because I wanted to write books, and I'm finally getting to that point after 40 years with NBC. So I went over as a summer replacement news writer, and television was just starting to grow then, and so I just stayed on. It was interesting.
This was 1950?
Yeah.
Had you seen much television?
Nope.
You had a TV, didn't you?
Nope.
You didn't own a TV?
9% of American homes had television in 1950. In today's dollars, those sets probably cost $2,000 or $3,000. By the end of the decade, in 1960, the price had come way down. By then, I had a television set, and there were television sets in, I think, 93% of American homes. But when I went to work for NBC, the sets were in either the living rooms of the upper middle class and the wealthy or in saloons.
Did that affect at all the way you programmed, the way you reported?
Not on the news. We were actually making it up then because there hadn't been anything before 1950 really called a network television news, and there really wasn't then right that particular year. So we didn't have anything to compare our work with, and we went ahead and simply designed various techniques that most of them are in place today. We invented the damn thing.
I guess it was 1957, you covered the Little Rock story where
I did.
Governor Orville Forbes was trying to prevent the desegregation of schools. Did you realize at that time the impact that television was going to have on the civil rights movement? This was going to be the first time where people saw... People described the war in Vietnam as being the first war that was in our living rooms, and the argument could be made it was really the civil rights movement, where we Americans sat in our living rooms and we watched, you know, the dogs being unleashed on demonstrators, and we watched cops coming in and dragging people away. Did you have a sense of what television was going to mean in the civil rights movement?
We did indeed. The civil rights movement had been going since about 1954, 55, so we'd had 2 years of covering what some of us called school news in the South. And we knew exactly what role television played, and it is this, that the media, and television is part of that, do not have the power to initiate social change in a country like the United States or indeed in any other country. What the media do is to accelerate and amplify the pace of social change if there's a good case for it. There was a great deal of social turmoil in the South, in the United States, about desegregation in the middle 1950s. And we knew full well, I'd been doing that for a couple of years, that what television did is it made that change move more quickly. It attracted more people into it, pro and con. And that's, I knew that when I got to Little Rock. I didn't know that they were going to call out the National Guard to stop the black children from going into the school. But we knew then full well the power of television in showing news and communities back to the people who lived in those communities. That was well known then.
You anchored the Today Show for about a year?
Year and a half, I suppose. 14 months, I think.
I assume that since you didn't stay long, you probably didn't like it very much?
Hated it is the word.
Why?
Well, it wasn't journalism, as far as I was concerned, with musical acts and things like that. I had done it against my will. NBC had turned the program over to the news department, and the news department at NBC picked me, a young foreign correspondent, to do it. And I went in kicking and screaming and went out kicking and screaming 14 months later.
When, in the years that you were anchoring, did a president ever call up and offer an opinion or a complaint about the way you or one of the reporters had handled a story? And if so, I wonder how you responded to it.
No, presidents don't call you with that. Their press secretaries do sometimes. Other members of the White House staff. Jimmy Carter called me once during the Wisconsin primary of 1980. I was in Milwaukee in a little newsroom we'd set up out there, and he called, and the White House operator came on and said, Mr. Chancellor, and I said yes, and she said, the president wants to talk to you, and I thought, oh, I know what this is about. This is about the hostages, and he's trying to put a certain kind of spin on some news that's coming about the hostages in Iran. And so he came on, and he said, hello, John, and I said, how are you, Mr. President? And he said, fine, I want to talk to you off the record. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but we have a rule around here that if we think that taking some information from anybody off the record, including presidents, is going to tie our hands at covering an important story, we can't take that information. And I sense, sir, that you're going to talk to me about the hostages, but I can't take it on off the record, so I'm sorry. So there was a long pause, and he said, I'll tell you anyway.
Yeah?
That's the end of the story.
Oh. So what did he tell you?
Nothing
you hung
important.
Up? Oh. Nothing you want to repeat or nothing important?
Nothing important.
So why was he calling you?
Oh, he wanted to spin the story on the hostages a little bit to his advantage, and what he told me, it wasn't even news.
And so what did you tell him?
I said thank you, and we never even used it. I can't remember the little tiny details, but it was not important news. We didn't even use it on the nightly news that night. Nor did we say, puffing ourselves up, that the president himself called with this information. It just didn't advance the story. It only advanced his candidacy in the Wisconsin primary, and so we just ignored it.
Can you discuss a story that raised the ethical question of whether this story should be killed because it might threaten national security, or whether it should be broadcast because you had the information and wanted to give it to the American public?
Well, we've had a lot of information about that we haven't broadcast over the years. Some of it I really regret. There was the Glomar Explorer, the CIA ship that was built to bring a sunken Soviet submarine off the floor of the Pacific Ocean. And we were asked not to do anything about that, even though the Russians knew about it. I think that was a mistake because the Russians knew all about it. But we should have run that story. There was another that I knew about back in 1979, which can be told now safely, and that is that we learned that not all the American hostages were where they were supposed to be in Tehran, that some of them had taken refuge in the Canadian embassy, and I knew that, and the New York Times knew it, and a number of other people. I suppose maybe 30, 40 people in all in the press knew it, and we never said anything about it until they were safely out, and then they told that story. So that we can keep secrets, and we have over the years kept a number of them.
When you're keeping a secret like that, are you wondering if the other networks have the information and if they're going to keep it secret too?
You never know.
But it's a risk you take that someone else might go with it, even though you've decided not to.
I don't think the judgment is made that way, though. I think the judgment is made individually by editors and their bosses who say, we accept the argument that this would endanger the lives of people or would endanger national security, and so you make it independently. There isn't any getting together with the Associated Press or the New York Times and saying, let's all get together and not run this. It's all done individually, as I think it should be.
I'm interested in your impression of this. I think there's a certain degree of cynicism now at the anchors who go to the hot spot to report from there, whether it's the earthquake in San Francisco or whether it's South Africa when Nelson Mandela is getting released. I think there's the cynicism of, okay, here come the big shots, and they're going to tell us the real story, as if the reporters there couldn't really give it to us on their own. And as a former anchor and as someone who's not participating in that now, I wonder if you have an opinion about it.
I really don't. I remember taking nightly news to China when Nixon first went in because we knew it would be the dominant story. One of the problems with doing that is if you send an anchor to Prague, the plane hits the Empire State Building in New York and your man is in Prague. It's risky to do that. And I don't know, I saw a lot of that going on in Eastern Europe last year. I haven't seen very much of it going on this year, so it may just have been a passing fancy.
You've been a political analyst for the past few years at NBC. I'm wondering, when you're writing one of the commentaries, is there a sense of how much is enough and how much is too much in terms of being opinionated?
Oh, I don't think so. I think people are, you know, I've done over about 1,000 of these things in 8 years, and I think people are pretty used to what I say. I try not. My rule is that I try not to be personal. I try not to make ad hominem arguments. I try not to say, I don't like Senator Dole because of his blue eyes or something. Actually, I like Senator Dole. But I try not to personalize it, and I still try to search for arguments about why things are right and why things are wrong.
I'm curious. I remember, I guess it was after you stopped anchoring and when you became an analyst, pronunciation of your name seemed to shift from Chancellor to Chancellor.
Well, we've always said Chancellor, and the announcers got a hold of it and began making it sound a little more oratorical at the end than I did. But I pronounce it Chancellor.
Why was there a shift in pronunciation in the way that the announcers were doing it? Had you asked for that?
No. I had started saying, when I stopped anchoring, I began to be allowed to say my own name. When you're an anchor, you can't say your own name. The announcer says it.
I see. Uh-huh.
And so when they heard me say Chancellor, they began saying Chancellor and stuff like that. I got a lot of ribbing from my friends, and it went away.
Well, John Chancellor, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
John Chancellor is the senior political analyst for NBC News. He's written a new book titled Peril and Promise, A Commentary on America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, journalist Hedrick Smith, the host of Public Television's Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Smith won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from the Soviet Union in the 70s. He's now writing a sequel to his bestseller, The Russians. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The State Department has announced that President Bush's Open Skies proposal has run into problems and says the Soviet Union is mostly to blame for the standoff. The department says a day before the deadline for a treaty, there are several key issues still in dispute, including the territory to be overflown by unarmed planes and the number of surveillance flights. Today, the president set a goal for sending a manned mission to Mars. The president said that Americans should plant the flag there within 30 years. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
NASA has been talking about sending people to Mars for years. And last summer, President Bush even stated it as an explicit goal of the space program, along with a space station by the end of the century and a base on the moon. Today, giving a commencement speech at Texas A&I University, Bush went one step further.
I am pleased to return to Texas today to announce a new age of exploration with not only a goal, but also a timetable. I believe that before Apollo celebrates the 50th anniversary of its landing on the moon, the American flag should be planted on Mars.
Bush didn't say how he plans to pay for this venture, which experts say could cost $500 billion. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar has arrived in Albania, the last Orthodox communist country in Europe, for 2.5 days of talks with government leaders. Pierre Vickery reports that the UN diplomat was warmly received.
Thousands of cheering Albanians lined the streets of the capital, Tirana, in an enthusiastic welcome for the historic visitor. Mr. Perez de Cuellar told the foreign minister, Reis Melile, that he was pleased to have arrived at a time when Albania was in the midst of a process of evolution. He had not come, he promised, simply to go sightseeing. The Albanian government is hoping to use the visit to demonstrate the extent of economic and political change since Ramiz Alia took over as president. They're hoping for Western development aid as well as UN support for an Albanian return after half a century of isolation to the international community. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
7 people were killed and over 80 others were injured today when an explosion hit a Philippine Airlines jet shortly before taking off in Manila. Survivors and witnesses gave conflicting accounts of how many explosions there were before the fire, with some saying as many as 3. Officials say a bomb may have caused the blast. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed 63 points to close at 2,801.58, on volume of 234 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In their native Africa, Dembo Kante and Kausu Kuyata are popular and respected masters of their complex instrument, the kora. But like many musicians, they enjoy jamming with unusual and stimulating company, even from as far away as Britain. When Englishmen and Africans make music together, world music commentator Milo Miles suggests a light touch is essential.
Folk musicians are forever possessed of the urge for a hootenanny. And particularly in the case of international performers, the idea makes a pretty picture. A bunch of guys and gals from different countries and different races sitting around and picking and grinning and grooving on each other's fancy licks. Unfortunately, the recordings of such get-togethers have often been pretty sterile. I suspect a big difficulty is rhythmic, since much Western folk music has a very regular, not to say plain stiff, beat. But in Africa especially, the flow and flux of rhythms is the essence of folk expression. One of the most eloquent vehicles for African folk expression is the 21-string instrument called the kora, usually described as a kind of combination harp and guitar. Its delicate plucking and chiming is especially treasured by the Mandinka people of Mali, Senegal, and the Gambia. The singing oral historians of these countries are called griots, and a griot who also plays the kora is called a jolly. So, of course, when a pair of master kora players made an album with a batch of eccentric English musicians, they called it Jolly Roll. ¶¶ The Jollies are definitely aces. Dembo Conte is the virtuoso son of the late Alhaji Bai Conte, who was roughly to the kora what Ravi Shankar is to the sitar, that is, the great popularizer of our time. Kausu Kuyata plays a rare 23-stringed kora, which produces an unmistakable, sharp, almost sour sound. Conte and Kuyata have made a couple of duo albums, and they both have soft, buzzing voices that are oddly soothing. When they sing back and forth, it's like different types of dry wood rubbing together. But Jolly Roll is an ambitious project involving bass, drums, electric guitar, accordion, and occasional horns. The album really comes alive when the unusual combinations of instruments are introduced. As Dembo Conte explains in the liner notes, we have not changed the kora from the traditional way. The musicians are following us, not the other way around. Most of the musicians who are doing the following are members of the English group Three Mustafas Three. Now, I'm not much of a Mustafas fan. Their send-ups of world music are not half as inventive and witty as they seem to think. But nobody denies that they know their polyrhythmic stuff. Hozam Mustafa's drums and Saba Mustafa's bass are unobtrusive but smart when they speak up, and John Kirkpatrick's accordion plunges into the swing whenever it appears. A few of the songs on Jolly Roll concern things like the will of God, the personalities of relatives, and musician get-togethers. But most of the tunes are praise songs, which seem a little strange by American pop culture standards. Praise songs celebrate the wise and revered, but they also have a habit of honoring the rich and powerful with an eye for the bigwig to return the favor. It's like Bruce Springsteen writing a hymn to Donald Trump so that Bruce would be hired to play at Trump's new casino. This isn't as craven as it sounds when you consider that the art patron system is often a necessity in Africa. You're not going to prosper without the favor of the wealthy, since record companies and average fans do not have the funds to finance much of a lifestyle. Besides, praise songs are an old and venerable tradition with Mandinka griots, and they seem to truly like the folks they honor. Why, the outstanding Jolly Roll even ends with this song of praise for all the people in Britain.
The Jolly Roll album is on the British label Rogue. Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Scott Spencer's 1979 novel, Endless Love, was both a bestseller and a critical success. Franco Zeffirelli's film adaptation couldn't give you a sense of Spencer's dizzying writing about an obsessive teenage romance. Although Spencer isn't responsible for that screenplay, he's written several others and is working with Paul Schrader on a remake of Laura. Readers often wonder how autobiographical Spencer's novels are, but his new novel, Secret Anniversaries, is about things that he couldn't possibly have experienced firsthand. It's set a few years before he was born, when America was divided about entering World War II. It's about a woman who falls in love with another woman, an aide to a congressman suspected of collaborating with the Nazis. This is the first time the two women touch.
Betty moved closer, waited. She seemed to be testing to see if Caitlin would move away. They both understood the first gestures would all have within them an element of the accidental, that they would have to be able to say, "Oh, sorry," or "Excuse me," at any point, and then withdraw, and that the fiction that they were only friends could then be preserved.
I like that paragraph a lot, because I think this is something everybody has experienced, you know, the sense of... I like the way you wrote it.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I experienced that the first time as I was out at a movie with a girl, the way you pretend like it's actually comfortable for your arm and shoulder to fling it around the seat that, oh, my goodness, you happen to be sitting in that seat, too. And it gives her the right, if she wants to move rather closer to your hand and maybe brush your hair against it. And that way you both have the protection of a manufactured accident.
You know, in most of your novels, there are these really wild, very passionate, very self-conscious love scenes. And I think I'm really interested in the self-consciousness and in sometimes the clumsiness.
Mm.
I think more than most writers I've read, you have a sense of the clumsiness that's so often involved in lovemaking.
Yes, well, I think if it really is lovemaking and not just some sort of display of sexual proficiency, it's necessarily clumsy because it's a meeting of souls, and it's a revealing of parts of character and personality and longing that remain otherwise hidden.
Is this your first novel that you've written in the third person?
Yes,
instead of first person.
It is.
You had tried to write in third person before, though, hadn't you?
It's true. It's always been something that I think I've tried to write all of my books in the third person. And I don't know why. Now that I've done it, I don't know what the big deal is.
Well, what is the big deal? What are some of the different things that you have to do in terms of finding the voice and in terms of moving characters in and out of rooms? Is it different in third person than it is in first person?
Moving characters in and out of rooms is not any more difficult. In fact, it's probably rather more easy in the third person since... you don't have to leave with them the way you do in the first person.
right, that's a good point.
finding a voice, I think, is trickier, maybe because it's hard to be living in 1990 and believe in omniscience of any sort. And so, you know, as you know, I do have a kind of secret narrator in this book that it's not an omniscient narrator. It is finally one of the characters who steps forward and lets us know that it's been he telling the story all along. And that was important for me because the kind of all-knowing and finally bland, authorial third person is uninteresting to me and doesn't really go along with what I'm interested in stylistically.
The first-person voices that you've used in some of your earlier novels have been very passionate, obsessive voices, and there's a sense of confession in the way the story unfolds. Is that something that you can't have in third person, that obsessive confessional quality?
Well, that's true. It would be difficult to have that in a third person, and it's probably one of the reasons why I wanted to write in the third person, because after having an obsessional confessional voice for a couple of novels running, I was sort of obsessed and confessed out.
Oh, uh-huh.
And was interested in enlarging my scope.
In some ways, are you trying to work within a certain genre form in the new novel?
Well, I'm interested and always have been interested in using the ingredients of so-called popular fiction, unbridled passion, ghostly visitations, and this one, World War II and politics, and seeing them through the more scrupulous lens of art. I've been dismayed for as long as I can remember that so many of the good stories seem to have been abandoned to people who aren't necessarily good storytellers whereas the most talented writers seem to be off writing a great deal about things that don't matter a great deal, things that are more matters of sensibility than of any pressing concern.
I have to ask you, most of the characters' names in your book are names that I think of as only being names that characters in certain kinds of novels have. Fulton Fleming, Caitlin Van Fleet, Sumner Wells, Elias Stowe.
Well, Sumner Wells is a real person.
Okay. Okay. We'll eliminate that one.
Well, let's eliminate that one.
That leaves us with Fulton Fleming.
That leaves us with a Fleming and a Van Fleet and a Stowe. And what would those certain novels be? You mean more pulpy pop novels?
Yeah, I guess pop historicals.
Well, you know, I don't really know.
Do you read them?
No, because I read too slowly to read bad books. It's a big investment for me to read a book. And I think that I write assuming the same about my reader, that I'm asking him or her to spend quite a bit of time with me, because I can't read a book in a night or even in 3 nights. It takes me quite a while to get through a book. So I've never been able to sort of knock off those historical romance books the way I suppose they were written to be knocked off.
Do you ever go back and reread your older books?
I but not sequentially.
You mean you don't read the books in order, or you don't read within the book?
I don't read within the book sequentially. I sort of jump around. And
what sends you back to one of your books?
Seeing them on the shelf, being at someone's house who has one, wondering if you know how I did something before. Nostalgia, narcissism. A wish to hear my voice, because I'm getting a little lost.
You mean in the new novel?
Right.
So when you feel like you're getting lost, it's easier to find your place if you read something that had a really sure voice.
A sure voice that reminded me that with enough work, I can actually get this done. Because, you know, there's always these moments of terrible loss of confidence in the middle of a book. You're all alone in a strange place, and you have no idea where you're going half the time.
What are the other ways of dealing with it?
Aside from drinking, you mean?
Oh, gosh, yes.
I don't know how to deal with it, Terry. You just have to keep some stillness within you that allows you to continue.
Do you become manic depressive when a book is out based on whether you get a good review or a bad review from critics who you respect? Or do you detach yourself from that altogether?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as manic depressive, but you know, it's hard not to react in some way, especially if you think you're being read in a foolish way. And it's hard not to feel that sometimes.
Not to feel that you're being read in a foolish way?
Right. I mean, it's sometimes a review is so beside the point and so misses what you're doing that you feel that you'd that yet another impediment has been put between you and the reader, and you wished it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. In your last two novels, there have been people who've lost someone they love through an act of basically political terrorism. If this is too personal, you don't have to answer it, but do you feel very close to that kind of experience, forgetting the political terrorism a second, but, you know, having lost someone you love?
I don't know why this is such a theme in my work, and it's been in a way in all of my books, because both my parents are still alive. I had no brothers and sisters to lose. Even my aunts and uncles are for the most part still with me. My kids are home and healthy. My wife's alive and she's in good health. But yet this question of personal loss, of some inner devastation, pulls me toward it time and again, and I don't really know why. I know that I can't get away from it.
Is it, I feel like I'm such a cheap analyst here, but is it maybe the fear of losing somebody?
It could be the fear of something like that, or it could be, I don't know. Of course, you know, if my next book, everybody's alive and happy and well, you'll know that I finally got that analysis we've been talking about.
Well, Scott Spencer, I thank you very much for talking with us.
It was good talking to you, Terry.
Scott Spencer's new novel, Secret Anniversaries, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, today we hear a report by Frank Browning about newly released documents which show that the Federal Bureau of Investigation was for many, many years engaged in surveillance of leaders of gay rights groups and generally of homosexual organizations. That story. Also, a talk with Nick Kristof of the New York Times in Beijing about the release of more than 200 people who've been in jail since the crackdown in Tiananmen Square last spring, and news of the desecration of a Jewish cemetery in the south of France.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Maureen Corrigan was going to do a piece for us this week about why there are so few novels around anymore about work. But she called us the other day and said she had bigger things than literature on her mind.
My critical edge has been dulled by the things I've been thinking about lately. Important issues like, should the invitations be engraved or laser printed? How many Doric columns should there be on the wedding cake? That's right, I'm getting married soon, and I've become a bridal pod person, invaded, body and brain, by alien thoughts about marriage. 3 days ago, I lost control of myself completely and bought a white wedding dress. I've already fought about this dress with the groom, as he's now known. He and I are in our mid-30s, and we see ourselves as feminists, as leftists, as people who want to resist rather than be co-opted by convention. A white wedding dress threatens our political identities. There's such a long train of normative cultural signs trailing behind it. Until this week, we've opposed most of the traditional wedding nonsense. The ceremony will be split second short. No Khalil Gibran, no embarrassing personal vows. We torpedoed the photographer's creative idea of superimposing our kissing profiles inside a champagne glass. The groom made a statement for friendship and against gender stereotyping by having his best man be a woman. Okay, we did give the caterer the go-ahead to erect a giant hors d'oeuvre sculpture, but every wedding needs some kitsch. As for clothes, well, I envisioned something slinky in green, a dress Carol Lombard might have worn on a dinner date with Gable. When I shared this dream with David, the man who cuts my hair, he said, "Oh, yes, I can't see you in white. After all, you're not 20 anymore." An image of Miss Havisham flashed into my head. Remember her? She's the aged spinster from Great Expectations who sits moldering in her wedding dress, waiting for the groom to show up. Dickens calls her a ghastly waxworks. I thought, why don't I just buy an off-white shroud? That way I can take care of two upcoming events with one dress. I left David's shop feeling insecure about my vanishing youth and my right to be a bride. So I bought a copy of Brides magazine. Don't laugh. It's full of helpful tips about wedding etiquette and bridal beauty. Like I didn't know that a week before the wedding, I must have my entire body waxed and bleached. The vats are simmering right now. After I read Brides magazine, regular dresses just look too plain. That's why I wound up at Kleinfeld's, the foofy dress center of New York. The dresses there are so encrusted with lace and bugle beads, they could walk down that aisle by themselves. I stumbled out of Kleinfeld's and fell into the arms of Jeanette, a no-nonsense Brooklyn dressmaker who's promised to make me look like a doll for the big day. The problem is, Once you decide to get married, you run smack up against the limits of postmodernism. I live much of my life inside inverted commas. But how ironic can you be when you're getting married? So I'm wearing white, ambivalently. The kind of dress I want, one that symbolizes both the specialness of the event and the flaws in the institution of marriage, may not be hanging on the racks yet.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. The big day is in July. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and commentaries, with production assistance from Roberta Sharrock, Joan Tuohy, and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet journalist Hedrick Smith. In the 70s, he won a Pulitzer for his reporting from the Soviet Union. Now he's hosting the PBS series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording of Carmen McRae singing Thelonious Monk. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.